Hey, so I would like to welcome all of you for the fourth and last lecture of Andy, well, last until last time we visit. Next time we visit, I hope. And you know, there is a little tradition here at the college, which is that on the occasion of the last lecture, after a month of lecturing, one delivers to the lecturer a little medal.
Oh dear, nobody told me.
So, Andy, here it is. You are being awarded.
My word.
A quite heavy medal for lecturing at Collège de France, which I hope you will put and display in the right place in your Columbia office.
Certainly. Well, thank you very much. Okay, so thank you all for bearing with me in this course of lectures, which, as I warned you at the beginning, was designed probably more to educate me than to educate you. So today, I want to conclude by giving you some theoretical background and some speculations about the experiments that I began with here. All right, so I started this sequence of lectures by alluding to two classes of non-equilibrium many-body phenomena that I think are of important current interest. The first is what happens under a steady-state drive. New phase is accessible under a steady-state drive. The most clean, in my mind, experimental example is the work of the Kyoto group around Yoshi Maeno on calcium ruthenate, where they showed that flowing current can stabilize a metallic phase in a material that would otherwise be a Mott insulator. Right? The other class of experiments is ones where a transient perturbation leads to a long-lived state with different properties. And the example I showed there, one of many, is the work of the Morrison group in Canada on vanadium dioxide, where they take a material in the low temperature insulating phase, they blast it with a laser, and that blast converts it into a metal, and the metallic phase apparently lives a very long time. So it seems to me that the essential questions of this field in this day and age are, how do we understand these kind of phenomena? All right, so just to remind you what I said before, calcium ruthenate is a material which, for pure Ca2RuO4 and for modest strontium doping, undergoes a metal insulator transition as you lower the temperature. Right? You can see this in this phase, in these plots, which concern properties of the equilibrium material. The transition from metal with low resistance to insulator with high resistance, note this is a log scale, occurs above room temperature for the pure calcium material. And as you add strontium, the metal insulator transition comes down to lower temperatures. In the same way, although I'm not going to have time to talk about this, the low temperature insulating state is magnetic. In fact, in these cases, anti-ferromagnetic with a weak extra magnetic moment that comes from essentially canting the anti-ferromagnetic moments. It's an interesting fact, which I will not be able to come back to, that in the non-equilibrium metallic phase, you apparently get a different magnetic transition, namely to a ferromagnetic state with a large polarization. So the ferromagnetic non-equilibrium state has interesting properties of its own. Now, this is equilibrium. If you go to non-equilibrium, this is a picture of current as a function of electric field dropped across the sample in the direction perpendicular to the conducting planes. At a temperature, this is the pure calcium ruthenate, which is below the metal insulator transition. So what you see is that for low electric fields, you get no current, and above a critical electric field, you get a relatively large current. So there's a metal insulator transition induced by electric field. I show the things on top just to remind you that this transition doesn't have any of the trivial explanations you might consider. In particular, they claim they know that the sample temperature is not heated by I squared R heating. The temperature really is this. And the conduction is not filamentary. The entire sample transforms. This is the volume fraction as judged by the strength of a particular diffraction peak. Right? So you really get a homogeneous metallic phase, which is different from what it is in equilibrium. All right. Here are the experiments that are in response to a current pulse. This is vanadium dioxide. Again, you see a metal insulator transition above room temperature. This scale is temperature in centigrade. You see a low resistance state at high temperature, a high resistance state at low temperature. The metal insulator transition is accompanied by a structural distortion, which is a little bit confusing to see on these plots. I'll come back to it briefly later. All right. Now, if you take the insulator somewhere down here at room temperature and you hit it with a laser pulse of some strength, this axis is fluence, which is basically the amount of power the laser puts into the material. If, and notice the zero is suppressed, you have 15, 10, 5, 0 is somewhere down here. If your fluence is less than some number, approximately 10 here, then you see this red curve is flat. For reasons I don't want to take the time to go into here, the authors attribute this to this peak as telling you that the structure is not changed at these fluences less than 9 or 10. If you go to higher fluences, then you see changes in the structure. Right. So this is the strength of a diffraction peak, which is indicating that you're still in the low temperature structure. The blue is the strength of a diffraction peak indicating something about electronic occupation of different orbitals. And the inset, which I expand here, shows you a measure of the conductivity. In addition to blasting it with a laser pulse at 1.5 eV, they shine light at a lower frequency inside the insulating gap. So in the insulating state here, you get essentially perfect transmission, right? Because you're shining light at a frequency inside the insulating gap, so there's nothing to absorb the light, all right? So on the other hand, if you hit it with some amount of laser power, you reduce the transmission, indicating that you've excited particles, which can then scatter the light. For modest laser power, the transmission goes back to something more or less 1, indicating it goes back to the insulating state. For slightly higher laser power, 3.7, which is the first point here, the transmission just goes to 0 and it stays there. Right? This scale shows it stays for 2.5 picoseconds. Other things in the paper say that this state persists over at least a 20 picosecond time scale. This transmission going to 0 is an indication that you put a lot of carriers which can absorb and scatter light into the gap. In other words, the implication is that you transform this insulator into a metal, and the metallic state lasts for a long time. Right. Here, this is this blue scattering curve I showed you before. The basic point is that after you blast it with a laser, you get a little rise time on the order of a picosecond, and then it basically stays over 20 picoseconds. All right. So, to summarize, we have two classes of experiments, a steady state drive, which puts the system in a different state from equilibrium, and a short pulse perturbation that appears to leave the system in a qualitatively different phase for a surprisingly long time. All right. Yes?
Just to make sure I understand your two things. So the statement from the two Bragg peaks,
yeah,
was that this metallization of the system does not correspond to switching to the structure.
Correct. Correct. That's the statement which is made in the paper. And it's this red curve being flat, which is no change in the crystal structure in this range. Okay. All right. So I now want to talk for the rest of the hour about what the theory, which I outlined for you in previous lectures, has to say about these situations. I wish to argue that, in fact, it does not satisfactorily explain them in each case. And then I wish to present more or less half-baked ideas, which I hope will become partially baked over the next 6 months, which may explain them. All right. So the basic theoretical tool that we have to address many body physics in and out of equilibrium in higher dimensional situations is dynamical mean field theory. If you want to talk about these non-equilibrium things, then non-equilibrium dynamical mean field theory. I explained to you before that our ability to actually solve the equations of dynamical mean field theory out of equilibrium and in a numerically controlled fashion is still very primitive. So the work I'm going to show you has been done with perturbative solvers whose accuracy may be questioned. Everything we know suggests that the qualitative behavior that you get out of these things is reasonably good, and the thing which is open is the quantitative accuracy. Right? But this is what's available, so we should go with it. Okay, now, let me start with some concepts from single particle physics and how they show up in a many-body calculation. Right? So the first concept is block oscillations. Right? And I warn you in advance that these are probably very interesting for cold atom systems and unlikely to be important in detail for reasons we'll get to in actual condensed matter systems that we're interested in. Right? So suppose that I take a system and I drive it in an electric field, just for the moment a static electric field. Right? One way to think about gauge invariance in the effect of electric field is that it just shifts the momentum to the momentum plus, in effect, the vector potential. And if you take the correct gauge, the vector potential is basically the electric field times time. So what an applied electric field does is move the momentum. All right? And if you have a periodic solid, then the momentum quantum number is periodic. So the momentum just goes around and around and around the Brillouin zone over time. Because the current is proportional to the sine of the momentum, that gives you an oscillating current, all right? With a period, which is just the 1 over the electric field, all right? And of course, all of this makes sense only if the scattering, if the momentum is a good quantum number on the time it takes to go around a period. In other words, if the scattering time is longer than the period, all right? In other words, that the scattering rate is less than this quantity, which is the voltage that you drop across a unit cell, which is a number that will come back. Okay, so now here are some dynamical mean field calculations I'm going to show you. They have been done solving models which are isolated, not connected to any reservoir, and therefore if you put them in the presence of an electric field, there will be I squared R heating, the temperature and therefore the energy will simply increase indefinitely. All right. So the first important work on this subject, at least to my knowledge, was done by Jim Friedrichs and collaborators about a decade ago. They studied the Falikov-Kimball model, which I probably should have defined here. But what it is you take the Hubbard model, and then you focus on the spin-up electrons, which you say can move, and you just say the spin-down electrons can't move at all. They're fixed in space, but at a position which is annealed, if you like, to minimize some sort of energy associated with the spin-up electrons. Right. So with that simplification, that the spin-down electrons are frozen, the model can be solved. It's basically single particle physics. All right. So here, they put on a big electric field. I think we're having problems with electric field here, but I guess we probably don't need to. Oh, here it goes. No, I can see it on my hand, but I think it's, yes, we're having problems with electric field there, so we will. This is a big electric field. You're dropping a voltage of order, a Hopping integral, across a unit cell. All right? So they solve this thing in an electric field, and what you see is a current which oscillates in time. If you take the non-interacting model, then this is exactly the block oscillations that you expect for non-interacting electrons. That's the black curve. Which is oscillating. As you increase the interaction strength, what you see is that the block oscillations are progressively damped. Oh, thank you.
Just press the red thing.
There is no red thing.
Center button.
Oh, I see. This central button. Yes, this is so elegant that it's black with a very faint red thing, and I couldn't see that it was there at all. Thank you very much. All right. So what you see is these things, you turn up the interaction. That, in effect, turns up the electron scattering. You damp out the oscillations. Closely associated with that, what you see is the so-called Stark ladders in the density of states. This results from the periodic evolution of momentum in the Brillouin zone. Right. And I should say, you see the oscillations get damped as you increase the interaction strength. The long-time behavior isn't quite accessed. Now, this was then later studied in somewhat more detail by Philip Werner and Martin Eckstein in the context of the Hubbard model with this so-called iterated perturbation theory solver, which is supposed to work best for weak coupling. Again, you see the phenomenon that you have block oscillations, which get damped as you increase the interaction strength. And I should say their conventions are such that all these interaction strengths are in the metallic regime of the model. As you increase the interaction strength, both the amplitude of the oscillations decreases, the period of the oscillations doesn't change, and the block oscillations appear to disappear above a critical interaction strength somewhere around between 1.2 and 1.4. Compare this to this, to this blue, to this purple, this light blue. All right. Okay. And again, it's tied to this same issue of the Stark ladder in the density of states. At weak interaction, you see the structure in the density of states associated with periodic motion of the electrons through the zone. As you increase the interaction strength, you increase in electronic damping. And although the figure is a little bit blurry here, what you can see is that you go to a stronger interaction strength, and the density of states becomes essentially constant. Yeah?
These are all zero temperature.
Well, no, but they're relatively low temperature calculations.
Now, the reason I'm asking this is that here the only source of scattering is the inelastic scattering.
Correct. Yes.
So if we have zero temperature, right, the inelastic scattering time is infinite.
Ah, but it's not, because you drive, once you drive the electrons out of equilibrium, then there is a scattering.
So, okay. So the scattering is actually scattering induced by the temperature.
Correct. Yes. And there is
that's the time. So both.
No. The period of the oscillations is just fixed. That's just E over, but yeah.
In the usual comparison, where one has to compare the period of the driving to the inverse scattering rate.
Yes.
Right? This scattering rate is itself dynamically generated.
Correct.
At equilibrium, if we were zero,
correct.
Really zero T,
correct.
This thing would have infinite.
That's correct. At equilibrium, yes. However, this is actually an interesting point. There's a transient behavior here which, to my understanding, hasn't been adequately explored. Because what it seems, and you can more or less see from these calculations here, that rather rapidly you get into this exponentially decaying regime. There's a transient of the sort you described where you start at more or less zero temperature in equilibrium, you start to drive the system, it goes out of equilibrium, you start to generate scattering. But by times of the order of, you know, one or two or three inverse bandwidths, you have driven yourself far enough out of equilibrium that the scattering basically is what it is. All right. So
the average of the energy of the system increases.
Yes.
I don't want to attempt thermalization issues, but I can think of this as temperature raising. And that's
I would look at it slightly differently. I'll show you in a bit plots of temperature. All right. But I would simply think of it as a strongly non-equilibrium state that opens up many channels for decay. It's not even clear that temperature is useful. The most important thing which was established was simply that the scattering rate clearly depends strongly on the interaction strength. And there is a transition above which this goes away. All right. And what is going on here really is it's just the underdamped to overdamped transition in the simple harmonic oscillator. And these guys, in fact, presented this beautiful picture here. And this is partly related to Antoine's question. All right. So what you see, all right, depending on the strength of the interaction and the strength of the drive, is the following. So what they do is they plot the time-dependent current versus the expectation value of the energy. All right. Notice that at infinite temperature, this thing has the conventions are such that this thing has energy zero. Right. We've chosen the model. They've chosen a model which is half filling. So on average, there's one electron per site, or half an electron of spin up and half an electron of spin down. All right. So if the electrons are uniformly distributed over sites, this average is zero. This average is zero. The electrons are evenly distributed over the band. That's zero. So the infinite temperature limit, in some sense, is zero energy in this model. All right. So what you see is that in the underdamped case, you get oscillations in the current, which spiral into this state of zero temperature. In the overdamped case, you get basically overdamped oscillator, and this is slightly underdamped in this. Right? So you see that as you turn on the time, it very rapidly, you almost only see the initial evolution in this case. Right? Goes to a state where the scattering rate is more or less saturated, and then you just get the understandable behavior that's in the either the overdamped or the underdamped case, depending on where you are. Okay. Now, of course, this is a highly artificial system. In real solids, unlike cold atom systems, the electrons are sitting in a lattice. They're coupled to the lattice degrees of freedom, and that provides a mechanism for heat to go out. So you can ask what happens if you now add a so-called thermostat, a coupling to some other degree of freedom, which you hold in thermal equilibrium and which can absorb energy from your system. All right? So if you do that and plot the current, what you see is that basically, this is again for relatively large drives, that depending on exactly what you do about the thermostat, you get a current which rapidly settles down to a steady state value, and the value depends on, if you like, the effective temperature, which depends on how quickly you take the energy out of the system. All right, now, this has an interesting consequence, which was pointed out by Camille Aron, who I think was also an author on this paper, and Cotillard. In particular, if you take the infinite dimensional Hubbard model and you tune it close to the metal insulator transition, well, here I should say, what happens, this is another way to answer Antoine's question, right? You start at zero temperature. There's a very short time transient where the temperature comes up to a quite high value. This is a log scale, here's one, right? And they put some damping and it saturates here. This is the no damping case where the temperature just goes up to infinity. Again, so you see the transient is very short. You turn on a current, you heat up the system. You turn on an electric field, you make a current, you heat up the system. Now, the single site dynamical mean field approximation, which essentially everybody is using in these calculations, has an interesting phase diagram, which I pulled from this paper, which is not at all relevant to our purposes, but mostly because I like the colors and because it shows the phase diagram in detail. All right. What you see is that as you increase the interaction through the critical strength of the metal insulator transition, you have at a quite low temperature, this is scaled, TC, a first-order metal insulator transition, which because of the incoherent nature of the insulator bends backwards. Right? So there's a low-scale metal insulator transition, and if you're in this region, essentially because the insulator has log 2 of entropy per site, there's a very low temperature at which you cross the metal insulator transition. All right. So what that means is that if you take a material which is tuned to the metal insulator transition, and you put on an electric field, very quickly you heat up the system to the point where it crosses the metal insulator transition, and then you have an insulator. So you have, for this particular model, which has this backbending of the metal insulator phase boundary, the interesting result that you drive a current, you heat the system, and it turns from an insulator, a metal into an insulator. All right. You see how it works here. This is calculations of the steady state electron spectral function for three levels of non-equilibrium drive, which are quite small because you're fine-tuned to a place quite close to the metal insulator transition. And you see as you turn on your electric field for some value of your dissipation into the reservoir, first you reduce the central peak, which is giving you metallic behavior, and then for slightly more you simply kill it completely. That's going across this transition and making you into an insulator. This behavior looks very much like the thermally induced metal insulator transition. There are differences, but you have to look with a lover's eye to see them. And in zeroth order, this is the thermal metal insulator transition, simply induced by the extra heat that your current has put into the system. All right. And you will notice that. You got it. This is a special feature of this, which follows from two things: fine tuning to this point, to near this point, and this backbending, which is a special feature of single-site dynamical mean field theory not coupled to everything, and which is clearly an oversimplification of a treatment of most materials, right? In particular, the crucial thing it relies on, all right, is the high entropy of the insulating state, all right? And we have to discuss, most of the experiments that Marcello was referring to have insulating states which are not characterized by a high entropy, all right? So that's why I believe that this looks different from the experiments. There are, of course, materials where there are insulating states which are characterized by a high entropy, and to my knowledge, these current-driven experiments have not been done on them. Yeah. So,
V2O3 would be an example. There are others, mm-hmm. like the Fagama transition, right?
Yeah.
By heating, you go into the localized states.
Correct. Yes. All right. So, but the other point I wanted to make was that by fine-tuning here, all right, you have a small field scale. This is essentially the voltage dropped across a lattice constant. And you can see that in for these particular parameters, which are really right next to the metal insulator transition here, you see you have this transition where the voltage you drop across a lattice constant is just a few percent of the bandwidth, right? And again, the small scale is essentially because of fine tuning. And the direction it goes is because of this particular behavior of the metal insulator transition. Okay. So that's one set of field-induced transitions between an insulating and a metallic state. All right. Now, there's another piece of physics, which single particle physics, which also ought to be relevant, and that's this is so-called Zener tunneling. All right. I'm sketching it here for the density of states of a Mott insulator, but of course this was originally pointed out in the context of band insulators. So if I just start with an insulator, I have filled states and empty states separated by a gap. All right. Now, if I take this insulator and I put a voltage across it, right, then as I go down my voltage gradient, of course, the local chemical potential changes. So I lower the energy of all the states. And at some point, I will bring the energy of the upper empty states in some layer n into alignment with the filled lower energy states in some layer 0. All right. So if I consider moving a distance d such that electric field times d is equal to this Mott gap, then I can have a transition. I can move an electron from one place to another. Right? Now, the probability of tunneling an electron over a distance d is typically exponentially small in d. So if you put that together, that gives you a current, which you would expect to be exponentially small in 1 over the electric field, because the distance d you need to go is some kind of gap divided by an electric field. Right? So what you expect is an exponentially small current, exponentially sensitive to the electric field. And then the interesting question is, if your insulator is some kind of self-consistently generated state, then you might say that as you increase your current, you increase your electric field, the current increases, and at some point, you can get to a large enough current to make the gap self-consistently collapse. Right? In other words, there might be a jump, presumably first order, because at any non-zero E, there's a non-zero J, that would cause a transition, in this case, from insulator to metal. All right. Now, in the single-site dynamical mean field theory, as far as we know, it doesn't work that way. Again, Eckstein and Werner, using, in this case, an NCA approximation, or its generalization, the one-crossing approximation, have found the Zener tunneling effect. Here you see a current. They multiplied this scale by 1,000. It's a very small current, which rises rapidly as you increase the field. They more or less fit it to this form. So you can find this Zener tunneling. Right? You can look at the properties. If the electric field is small enough, then you see block oscillations of your tunneling current as you make it bigger. The block oscillations go away for the reasons we discussed before. Furthermore, as you add current, you increase the temperature of your solution and you increase the number of doubly occupied sites. All right? So what you wind up with, and this is sort of interesting, so what you wind up with when you have this Zener tunneling effect is, oh, and I should have said this is the threshold field just defined from this fit as a function of the interaction strength. So you can see that it more or less scales with the Mott gap. So the interesting thing that they found was as follows, all right? You turn on an electric field which is basically big enough to see something, all right? And you get a current which is approximately a steady state. However, you get a temperature which continues to rise. And similarly, if you measure, for example, the number of sites that have two electrons on them, the number of doubly occupied sites, and I believe this statement percentage is in error, actually, you also get something which continues to rise. So what they say is that basically what you get is a non-thermal state, indeed a non-steady state, with a time-independent current, but a gradually increasing temperature. And remember, this is in the class of models which are not coupled to a thermostat. So clearly, a large fraction of the excitations you make can't move at all, and some modest fraction can. All right. But the main point I wanted to make was that as you do this, the transition, resistance versus temperature, is smooth. Right? So there's no transition in this theory. You just unwind the insulating state into a state with current flowing. And there can be a rapid crossover because you're living off this exponential. But there's no transition in what they found. All right, so to summarize, what dynamical mean field theory has said about current-driven transitions in Hubbard and related models is that first, you should think about these things in an approximately single particle way, using the concepts of Bloch oscillations and Zener tunneling that you know from single particle physics with essentially the obvious generalizations of scattering. All right, the second point is that the non-equilibrium properties, of course, depend on whether energy is conserved or whether you have a mechanism for taking energy out of the system. And the third thing is that unless you fine-tune things very close to a transition, the field scales are of the order of unity. What you need to do to see anything interesting is drop a fraction of the order of a tenth or something of the Mott gap in terms of voltage. You need a voltage drop over a unit cell, which is of an electronic scale, let's say of order a tenth of a Mott gap. All right, so here's an observation. I just took this information from a talk given this summer by Yoshi Maino. This is the calcium ruthenate thing we talked about. These are the fields at which these correlated insulating materials become metallic. All right, now if you just put in numbers, assuming that this field is dropped more or less uniformly over the whole sample, what you see is that at the biggest, the voltage drop over a unit cell is a little less than half a millivolt. You get down to calcium ruthenate, and it's much smaller. So in the actual materials, the metal insulator transition is driven by voltage drops across a unit cell, which are several orders of magnitude smaller than what makes sense in terms of this single-site dynamical mean field approach. So the implication is that in the materials that we have to deal with, the current-driven metal insulator transitions are really the local physics given in DMFT is not the point. They're a collective phenomenon in which the effect of the current on longer length scale physics needs to be properly considered. Right? And it's an open question that I'm basically going to leave you with of what that physics can be. I just want to make two simple observations. All right? The first is, the other thing I sort of said, as you saw from the previous slides I showed, was that the physics of the dynamical mean field calculation is that basically the voltage drive heats the electrons. It accelerates them, eventually they scatter off each other, off of other things, and they come to a relatively high temperature. So everything is given by, let's say, hot electron, strongly scattered physics. Right? What you need, therefore, is two things, an effective temperature for an order parameter for the metal insulator transition, even if the electrons stay cold, and a long length scale, which can give you a high, a small voltage, a small critical field, even in the presence of, anyway. All right, so without giving you a theory, because I don't quite have it yet, of these metal insulator transitions, I want to make two observations which come from theoretical studies of non-equilibrium effects on magnetic quantum critical phenomena. So this is, again, some time ago with Aditi Mitra, we considered the following highly artificial situation. You take a little layer of ferromagnet, shown here in gray, you stick it between two reservoirs which have a current flowing across them like this. right? So you take your thin layer of ferromagnet, you got a current flowing across it, and you ask, what does that current do to the magnetism? All right. And the answer is encoded in this kind of quantum critical phase diagram, where you have a tuning parameter, which is a property of this layer, which in equilibrium at zero temperature would tune you from a magnetic phase to a non-magnetic phase, and you have a voltage drive instead of temperature. All right. Now, I don't have the time to explain how we actually did this, but basically this class of theories is simple enough that you can just apply all the standard path integral methods out of equilibrium and construct a theory of the voltage-driven transition. All right? And what you learn is that you have a transition which has approximately thermal behavior here. All the exponents are thermal, and in critical phenomena language, for those of you who like it, basically the differences from thermal transitions show up only in subleading corrections to the basic critical phenomena. All right? However, all of this happens when the electrons, which are equilibrated to these reservoirs, are at zero temperature. So there's an order. So what you learn from this theory is that you can have an order parameter temperature which is different from and higher than the electronic temperature, right, which can drive transitions. Now, the second problem that we did is also instructive. We then took this problem and just turned it on its side. So we said that instead of having a current across the thin dimension, you just have a current in plane with this itinerant electron ferromagnet. You get essentially the same story, but interestingly, the relation between the applied voltage and the effective temperature is given by this formula, right? In which the effective temperature is the electric field you apply times some kind of scattering length. In this simple theory, it was the electron mean free path, all right? But in general, some length of the system. So that the effective temperature governing this kind of theory is the voltage drop not across a unit cell, but across some much larger length scale. All right? So what that suggests to me is that what's going on in calcium ruthenate, and probably in these other materials, is that a relatively small gap gives you a long length scale, and for that reason, a relatively small electric field can give a high order parameter temperature, even though the rest of the sample and its electrons are more or less in equilibrium with a reservoir at a lower temperature. Right? And I believe that that's the lines along which all of these existing experimental metal insulator transitions need to be understood. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about current-driven things, and now I wanted to change gears and talk about the voltage pulse-driven experiments. So, yep. I think that it's the former, and this is mostly because I don't see a good mechanism for the electric field directly inducing the structural transition. Right? Basically, it's even parity across the layer. It doesn't even couple to the electric fields in first order. So my belief is that it's the electrons do something. Yeah, exactly. Correct. Yeah. So my belief is that you're doing something to the electrons, and that causes both the electronic structure to change, and that drives the structure.
So in that sense, comparison with models in which we only have electronic things of freedom
is not an insane thing to do. Yeah. I think that the second question, if one has a satisfactory theory in terms of just the electrons, is then to ask about the kinetics of the transition, because and it will relate to this. The question is, how much do you really have to drag the lattice around in order to see the effects? Can you see an effect on the electrons before the lattice moves, or do you have to wait for the lattice to move in order to see the change? And I think that's an interesting and open question. Okay, so this is to remind you about the vanadium dioxide experiments. This is just what I said before. You have a material, it has a metal to insulator transition. You blast it hard enough but not too hard, and you don't change the structure, and you do change the electronic state. Right? So this thing lives a long time, and the first question to ask is this lifetime of this apparent conducting state a consequence of slow single electron kinetics, or is there something richer going on? Right? Now, already you see in these data a suggestion that there's something richer going on, right? If you hit it not too hard, the thing comes back to more or less where it was before. This difference is actually basically explicable in terms of heating since you've put some energy into the system, right? And this gives you a reasonable estimate of what the timescales are. However, it's worth looking into this in a little more detail. Now, this is what I said I promised to show you before. Basically, the metal insulator transition is associated with a structural change, in which you go from a high temperature rutile phase to a low temperature monoclinic phase in which pairs of vanadiums, like this guy, get close together. Or this guy is compared to these two, right? So this dimerization occurs at the metal insulator transition. And the statement from the experimentalists is that you generate a metallic phase even though you keep the dimerization the same. All right. Now, to make this metal insulator transition work, you need two moving parts. All right. This is just a restatement of work that was done basically here by Silke Biermann and Antoine and others. But this is a Hartree-Fock band structure done by Zoran He, who's a student with me at Columbia, in the insulating phase. You have lots of d orbitals, and the nomenclature is different depending on which person you talk to. For us, the x squared minus y squared orbital is the one involved in the dimerization. You see you have a bonding band and an antibonding band. So the dimerization splits those two guys. But in addition to make this thing insulating, you have to take the other d orbitals, in our notations primarily the xz and to some extent the yz, and also separate them, right? So you need two things, an interaction-enhanced dimerization and an interaction-enhanced crystal field splitting. And you need them both to happen to get the insulating phase, to get the insulating phase, right? This is just to drive home that point. This is work from this pioneering paper. Just focus on the dashed lines. This is what happens if you do density functional theory of the in the low temperature structure. You see the dimerization more or less like we had it before. The thing is that the other orbitals, these blue dash things, are not separated. What you really need your interactions for is to separate these other orbitals. All right. Now, the experiment, they excite things at 1.5 electron volts, which is chosen basically for experimental convenience. So what that does is it takes holes out of here and puts it 1.5 volts up here. Basically, that in this material happens to very naturally couple to this bonding antibonding splitting. So it's very likely, in fact, that the main optical absorption channel is really to just take things out of the antibonding state and put them in the bonding state here, right? And then you can ask, how quickly, what happens to the carriers after you do that? So now I want to make a little digression and ask, what do we know in simpler interacting models about how carriers decay, all right? In other words, how we think about photoexcitation, all right? So again, single particle concepts get you fairly far along this picture. You start with an insulating state. You do photoexcitation. I didn't have my picture of photoexcitation. You take holes out of here, you put them up here. That creates some number of doubly occupied sites. That means that the energy goes up. In first order, you make delta n excitations. Each excitation makes a doubly occupied site. Your energy goes up by this amount. All right? So by doing photoexcitation, you put yourself in a high energy state, but not in first instance a thermal state. And then you can ask, how long does it take for this thing to thermalize? Right? So this has been studied in the Falikov-Kimball model, which our friends Friedrichs and others have looked at. Basically, the thing never thermalizes. The doubly occupied states live forever. There's essentially, you make a photoexcitation, which is here, and then nothing changes. Right? In the Hubbard model, some amount of thermalization is possible. There are two things that can happen. First, you could recombine. Right? And if you recombine by taking an electron and combining it with a hole, right, then you have to do something to liberate the excess energy. So basically, you have to take some other electron up here in the conduction band and kick it up to a higher energy like I sketched here. All right? So that tells you that something very funny is going to happen to the kinetics if the insulating gap is bigger than the width of this band. All right? If the insulating gap is bigger than the width of this band, then you don't have enough room to move this guy up to accommodate the energy you need to recombine these guys, right? So there is therefore a dichotomy between a strong coupling large gap limit, where essentially holes and doublons can't recombine, and a weaker coupling modest gap limit, where there is this three-body, what you might call an Auger process, to let them recombine. Right? It also goes the other way. If I start out with a guy up here, it could relax down here and create another electron-hole pair. Again, if the amount of energy I can get by doing this is greater than or equal to the amount of energy it costs here. Right? So if I start with a highly excited guy, I can actually increase my number of doubly occupied sites by this Auger, what you might call upscattering, because it scattered this guy up. All right. Now, that's the processes that can relax the number of empty and doubly occupied sites. Of course, once you have empty and doubly occupied sites, the distribution in each band can thermalize, particularly if you're coupled to other degrees of freedom, such as spins and phonons. All right, so this has been studied in detail in the Hubbard model. To my mind, again, the best results have come from Werner and Eckstein. This is a plot of the number of doubly occupied sites normalized to the number you would get at the thermalization temperature. So you remember, if you go back to here, you put in this much energy. You could ask, what temperature corresponds to that much energy? And then you could ask, how many doubly occupied sites are you going to get? And you could see if things approach it. Right? So at modest interaction, when the insulating gap isn't too big, you relax with some exponential time constant to the number you expect. On the other hand, if your gap gets too big, then you lose the relaxation. So this is the effect I told you about before. Right. You can also look at the details of relaxation within a band. This is a really rather busy figure whose purpose is to show you simply that the way things relax depends on the amount of excitation level, and the time constants are of order a few inverse bandwidths. All right. Now, you can look at these time constants in detail, and this is actually a study which was done beyond the single-site dynamical mean field theory using a four-site cluster method, which will give you some handle on magnetic degrees of freedom. And you can attempt to relate the relaxation of states within a band to other properties. In particular, this is the relaxation time defined from the evolution of these curves, all right, plotted versus the effective temperature, which relates to how many excitations you have and what the physical temperature is they put in the sample, right? And what you see is that the relaxation times are long in the high temperature limit, where the spins are basically disordered, and short in the low temperature limit, where you have, if you like, a lot of magnons. In this case, it's gapped excitations over the plaquette, but still, to relax things. Right? If you convert all these numbers into times using all the, you know, translating the bandwidth and so on into units appropriate for oxides, what you say is that these times range from 10 to 100 femtoseconds, give or take. All right. So to summarize, the kinetics of the Hubbard model is that you have a thermalization on a relatively rapid time scale, 10 to 100 femtoseconds, to a local equilibrium state where you have a fixed number of electrons, a fixed number of doubly occupied sites, and a fixed number of empty sites, right? Then you have a typically slower relaxation of the doubly occupied sites via these recombination processes, right? And there is a very significant kinetic barrier to recombination if the Mott gap is large compared to the bandwidth. If the Mott gap is not large compared to the bandwidth, then the recombination goes reasonably quickly. I didn't show it, but if you translate this back into physics of the order of a picosecond or two. Okay, so that's the basic situation. Now, in the last few minutes, I'd like to show you some things that Zoran did, which are on a much simpler level, but to start with are consistent with what I just told you. Right? So we took VO2, we took the Hartree-Fock band structure I showed you, and then he wrote down what's in essentially a Boltzmann kinetic equation, living off the Hartree-Fock band structure with the Slater-Kanamori U and J interactions. Right? Now, there's an interesting point here. The states at the lower Hubbard band edge and the upper band, oh, first point, just the gap is clearly small compared to the bandwidth. Recombination is going to happen relatively happily. You have a lot of room here to deal with the energy produced by recombination. Right. Second point, though, the states here and here are of different orbital character. If these guys are going to relax to these, or indeed excitations here are going to relax to here, you need processes that change the number of electrons of a given orbital type. Right. Now, basically, the interactions don't do that for you. Everything in the Slater-Kanamori interactions, except the pair hopping term, conserves the number of electrons in a given orbital state. What actually changes the number of electrons in a given orbital is simply the bandwidth. Right? There's some kind of hopping process. The orbitals don't commute with the hopping matrix element. So it's that non-commutativity, the fact that an electron can hop from orbital A on site 1 to orbital B on site 2, which provides the orbital relaxation. Right? And it's small, but it's not that small. Okay. So, you make the optical excitation. And what he finds is first that you start with some number of holes here and electrons here. And that distribution thermalizes relatively quickly. These are the results of solving this Boltzmann equation. And what he shows you here is the density of electrons and holes, that's blue. All right. And this is from some model of the optical matrix elements. And then in red, what you would get if you took this energy and you said, all right, I'm just going to take a thermal distribution of electrons with that mean energy and a thermal distribution of holes with that mean energy. Right? So you start out with an athermal distribution. And then things evolve on a time scale of a few femtoseconds. And again, this time scale really comes from the part of the hopping, which doesn't conserve orbital index. All right, to an essentially thermal equilibrium distribution. Right? So the picture that one has is that after a very short time on the scale of these experiments, things relax within the constraint that you have a number of holes and a number of doubly occupied sites. Right? Within that constraint, things thermalize almost instantly. Right? So then if you want to study the dynamics on longer time scales, it's straightforward because you can assume that these guys are thermalized instantly, and these guys thermalize instantly. So then after that, the relaxation will take place in two ways. You can have an Auger downscattering, in which I combine one of these guys and one of these guys. That will kick an electron up to here, right? And then this will relax down almost immediately, thermalizing with these guys. Or you can have an Auger upscattering, in which I take an electron here. I take an electron here. I kick it up to this band. And I steal the energy from some guy in the tail of this distribution up here. Right? So that lets the number of electrons and holes relax. And this is what you get. Right? That again, on a scale of tens to twenties of femtoseconds, in fact, the Auger upscattering process dominates. And you wind up increasing the number of electrons until you get this essentially thermal distribution characterized by a number of electrons and a number of holes, which is larger than was in your original pulse by a factor of about 2.
And yeah? Just one thing. So VO2 doesn't have magnetic order, right? So the Hartree-Fock part of this calculation is entirely about orbital polarization.
Correct. Plus the dimerization, right? There's an extra Hartree-Fock term in the dimerization. Yeah. Right. So again, all of this, we just kept the band structure fixed. So this is within a rigid band picture, and doing the self-consistent time-dependent Hartree-Fock is in process but not done. Right? But this tells you what you need to know basically about the time scales. Okay. So, and this is all under the assumption that you live in this electronic world where energy doesn't go out of the system. Right? So a key question which hasn't been addressed yet is how fast does energy go out of the system? And the naive estimate I would make is that the time for electron-phonon coupling to lower, to take energy out, is broadly of order 1 over a Debye frequency. That's a typical size of an electron self-energy due to electron-phonon scattering, right? And that's going to give you, again, numbers in the ballpark of 100 femtoseconds. Magnons, which, as you say, are not relevant to this precisely, would give you a kind of similar time scale. All right? So what that means is that, going back to here, on a time scale of 100 femtoseconds or picosecond, each of these distributions, which is characterized by a non-zero and indeed quite high temperature, because you can see there's a broad width here of electrons and of holes, should cool down by emitting phonons. And as it cools down, it should then, particles and holes should recombine. So the whole thing, therefore, should fall apart on a scale of a few picoseconds. And yet, as far as we can see, it doesn't. So that's the essential paradox raised by this experiment. Now, there's a lot of things to criticize in this simple Hartree-Fock analysis that we did, right? But the argument I would like to make is that while these criticisms are valid and there's possible to do a much better job, it's sort of beside the point. We have factors of 10 or more problems with timescales, and doing a better job of our calculation is unlikely to solve the problem on that scale. So I believe, therefore, that if the experiment is right, there is some other physics which is beyond the single particle picture, which is stabilizing this conducting state. Right. So in the last few minutes, I want to sketch a possibility, which I have to say is not favored by the estimates that I just gave you for the number of carriers you make and so on. But still, it's worth, I think it's worth thinking about. So, I showed you this Hartree-Fock band structure before. I said that there are two moving parts to the insulating phase, an interaction enhanced dimerization and the crystal field splitting that gives you these things. So you might ask, are there other, what can you do about this? Are there other solutions? All right? So anyway, we did a Hartree-Fock theory, which has both an intersite interaction whose factorization gives you this enhanced dimerization, and an on-site U. All right? And what we find out is that at zero temperature, this Hartree-Fock theory for appropriately chosen U parameters has two extrema. This is the insulating extremum that you know about, which is lower energy. It's the favored one at low temperature. This has almost no XZ electrons. If I go back to the band structure, that's these purple things. And there's a higher energy extremum, which can be favored by somewhat larger values of the interaction, which has a much higher number of XZ electrons. In other words, whereas basically very little happens to the dimerization part of the Hartree-Fock. All right? So what the higher extremum does is it essentially shifts the X squared minus Y squared and XZ bands so that your dominant occupancy is XZ. Here's the dimerization, which is more or less preserved. All right? So within the framework of Hartree-Fock theory, this solution exists. As you can see, it's very high in energy, but it's there. So the question you can ask is, therefore, the possibility I would like to raise is that the optical excitation has somehow tricked the system into falling into this minimum. All right. So, to provide some evidence for that, what I said was that the optical excitations, or what we saw from the elementary kinetic calculation, was that on a very rapid timescale after the optical excitation, things equilibrate given the constraint of fixed number of electrons in empty sites. Right? So let's just ask about equilibrium as a function at an effective temperature, which is relatively high. So let's just ask about equilibrium at an effective temperature. All right, and ask what happens to the Hartree-Fock solution as we raise the temperature. All right, now this is an obvious place where we should be able to do much better. As we all know, Hartree-Fock is a lousy theory of higher temperature behavior. All right, but if we just stick with it, nevertheless, as you raise the temperature for some values of this interaction, what you see is that you switch from this minimum to this minimum. This is essentially the energy difference from the between the centroid of the X squared minus Y squared band to the XZ band. All right? And you can see that as you raise the temperature, the Hartree-Fock solution wants to switch. And this is all, again, assuming that the lattice and the basic dimerization remain in the low T structure. All right, now, to get this to work, this is the effective temperature that we get taking into account all the experimental parameters, saying how much fluence they put in, how thick is the film, how much energy was really dropped there, blah, 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 right? What we find for their fluences is effective temperatures between 0.1 and 0.2 EV per cell. And by the way, for those of you who like these things, the cell has 4 vanadiums, right? That's about a factor of 2 lower than the temperatures you want to make this transition happen, but it's not a factor of 100. All right. So then you can go on and make a little phase diagram, and you can ask, suppose that I make this transition at a high temperature, and now I just cool it down adiabatically. Does it stay stable? In other words, within Hartree-Fock, so there's no tunneling between minima, does the minima stay well-defined? Right? And in this green and red region, the higher minimum stays well-defined. That's here. So therefore, you might at least hope that the system could stay in it down to a low temperature, and that the kinetics of getting out of this solution into the one we know as the lower energy solution will be much slower and will involve the kinetics of nucleating one phase inside another. All right, so that's the proposition then, or the intriguing possibility, is that the experiment has actually put the electrons into this metastable phase, which we know exists, right? And that's the reason why the thing can persist over timescales which are much longer than any reasonable estimate of one electron timescales, right? Now, apart from the obvious deficiencies, theoretical deficiencies of what I told you, this was all based on Hartree-Fock, right? There's another big question which is not answered either by the experiment or by the theory. Right? Suppose you buy this picture, or indeed the just the experimental interpretation, that you have dramatically changed the orbital occupancy. Right? You change the orbital occupancy, that will make a force on the lattice. Right? The lattice at low temperature in equilibrium is where it is because it's in equilibrium with the forces made by the electrons occupying different orbitals. Right? So if I kick a bunch of electrons out of the x squared minus y squared orbital, it should have no reason to dimerize as much as it does. Right? And therefore, on some time scale, there has to be a force which wants to unwind the dimerization. And you may ask, in this interpretation, why don't these guys see it? What is that time scale? So that's another open question that we don't have a good answer for, right? But clearly needs to be investigated. All right. So to summarize what I told you, basically, the picture that I have from experiments is that they give you indications of intriguing non-equilibrium collective phenomena, right, which have to be understood in the language of long wavelength physics and stability of phases which don't necessarily exist in equilibrium. We have hints to say that such theories are possible, and I think the task for the next amount of time is to figure out if this is really right. So with that, I'll stop and thank you for your attention.